Hey there, welcome back. We say to new and regular listeners from around the globe, this is Red Ice Radio, headquartered out of the west coast of Sweden. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we continue to pursue the answers to many of the questions that we find fascinating and important. We seek freedom, authenticity, understanding, and also a wider perspective. And you can learn much more at redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. Today we're going to proceed to outline the story of the Swedish tragedy. Klaus Bernpenkner is a senior fellow of the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Sweden. He is also behind Freedom Fest that takes place annually in Stockholm. Today our focus is Swedish conformity, disaster, socialism, government hegemony, economy, free markets, and some history on Sweden that I bet you never knew about. Hi Klaus, thanks for coming on Red Ice Radio with us. It's good to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. So if we start a little bit in the beginning here, in terms of your interest, when did you get interested in Mises and the Austrian School of Economics? And I'm just curious to know kind of how you were exposed to some of this material, considering that you are just like me from Sweden. And I mean, sure, there are a few of you and us around, but it's a small group of people, right? I mean, I find it somewhat of an anomaly, right?
Yes, it's the matrix is strong, and not many people have managed to break free, even though there are more and more of us. I would say that my own story began maybe 6 or 7 years ago. I was working in the financial industry, and I was trying to understand the financial crisis. I myself have a number of degrees and things, and I'm supposed to be understand those things as well as my colleagues. They should also have been very well trained to understand where financial crisis comes from and so on. But everybody was surprised when the crash of 2007-2008 came.
Yeah,
we had entered a new economy, the super cycle. We had overcome all the past business cycle swings. And despite that, it all crashed. So I asked a number of people that I thought smart and well-educated, and I could not get a single satisfactory answer. So I started looking around myself. There has to be somebody who understands these things. So I found a handful of people online that had predicted it. And I started looking at their theories, their background, their understanding, what models, what thinking were they using. And I started looking at Peter Schiff, actually. There's a funny video out that a lot of people have seen. Peter Schiff was right, where he's being laughed at by all the talking heads. And eventually he was right when he talked about the financial crisis coming and the bubble in real estate and so on.
Yeah.
So I followed him for a while and I started looking at links from his site. And at that time, I also started to think myself, because I realized there has to be something wrong with this theory that I've been taught. So I started thinking myself, how should a proper economic theory be constructed? So I started out very, very simply and I sort of figured, okay, two people working together, add some more people, add some other complicating factors and so on, trying to build up sort of an economy, a theory for an economy that way. And while I was thinking along these lines, I stumbled upon something called Austrian economics. And I started reading it, and first it seemed to be a different language. I didn't understand much of it. But I had the feeling that this was actually what I was looking for, what I was trying to build. And as I continued reading, I realized that this was exactly what I was looking for. This is where I could find answers to where the financial crisis come from. And it explained that it's actually not a natural phenomenon, but it has some very specific causes. And the root cause of it is our central banks. And the central banks are only an extension of the government. So the root cause of financial crisis was government. And I guess you could say that in my life I always had kind of strange views on many things.
A little bit outside of the box?
Outside of the box, yeah.
Yeah.
And when I realized that government was ultimately the cause of financial crisis, I started to think, well, maybe government causes problems in other areas too. And I soon realized that they basically all the problems we have in modern society are created by governments. In schooling and healthcare and wars and police and they all have the same root cause. And at that point, I realized that maybe I don't believe in government. But what does that make me? Well, it makes me an anarchist. And at that point, I became a little bit scared, actually, because
right.
We all know what anarchists are. You know, they throw bricks and rocks through shop windows and
right.
they fight in the streets and so on. But I was forced to come to the conclusion that's what I am. That's what I believe. I don't walk around calling myself an anarchist, you know, every day because it has a lot of negative connotations for people.
Sure.
So I prefer to talk about free societies. And sometimes I have to clarify that a little. And sometimes I say, I believe in a free society instead of democracy. And that confuses people sometimes because to many people, democracy is freedom. And to me, it's just another type of government. So that's my story to my path to the freedom movement.
Very good. Now, did you have resistance to the material, considering your background and your education? In the beginning, when you got into it?
If I had resistance from within myself?
Or yeah.
Probably, well, the Austrian, not much, actually, because the Austrian, many people come into the freedom movement from different angles. I came in through Austrian economics. Other people come in through, they just believe that it's wrong to put people in cages for so-called crimes which don't harm other people. Other people think war is wrong, and they come to the conclusion that the government is behind that. So there are many ways in. My way was quite smooth through economics. Because true economics is the best, I would say, the strongest proof against government. But I was, as I said, I was a bit scared for a short while when I realized the implications of these ideas.
Do you think that had to do with being brought up in Sweden and, again, your education?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Education is a very, very strong conditioning tool. And maybe we'll talk a bit later about Sweden. I think Sweden is unique. Sweden has a uniquely uniform or narrow spectrum of opinions.
Yes.
I don't know any other country in the world where that is the case to that extent. So that definitely had a part in sort of why I was feeling that way towards freedom initially.
Now, if we just talk a little bit about some of the mirrors here, because Sweden is an interesting period. Back in the 90s, we went through a very similar situation with the, you know, the real estate bubble happening. We had bailouts and basically a large extent to what happened later in the with the world economy, and specifically then in the United States under 2007, 2008. Did you see these parallels and patterns as well? Of course, the situation was dealt with somewhat differently in certain extents, but it was still very much the same. Did you see this as well?
At that time, I didn't see it because I didn't have the tools. I didn't have the right glasses on to be able to identify these kind of similarities in history. I just had no clue. I had no clue where this came from. So it was a surprise to me. Of course, I didn't believe that things would go on forever the way they were, but I didn't have the tools to understand why. It was just a gut feel.
Very good. Now, we're going to, of course, get into more on Sweden, the Nordic model and the the economy and kind of how you view that there. But maybe first you could define, you mentioned true economics. Maybe you can define that a little bit for to our audience who don't know what that means.
Well, true economics, it's, I sometimes call Austrian economics true economics. It's a branch of, it's a way of looking at the world, which was founded, I guess you can say. It has actually has a long tradition from way back to the Catholic monks in Spain. But it's called Austrian economics because at the end of the 1800s, there was an Austrian called Karl Menger who was trying to solve some economic problems that at that time really, really frustrated economists. One of these problems is the question of why, for example, it's usually put this way, why is bread cheap and why are diamonds expensive?
Right.
I mean, we need bread to survive. We don't need diamonds. So why is bread cheaper than diamonds? So the economic theory at that in that day, that paradox could not be resolved. So he set out to solve that, and he did so by looking at economics starting with individuals instead of looking at a big system. Like the father of economics, we all know who he is. His idea was that the wealth of nations, he made some breakthroughs by explaining to people that economics is not a zero-sum game. Everybody can gain at the same time. And that did away with a lot of bad economic theories. But he also introduced some new ones. And he did so by looking at the world as a big system and forgetting the individual. Karl Menger started from the individual and sort of deduced the entire economic, everything that happens in the economy from individuals. And that gives a totally different view on things. And because of his contribution and others that followed him, they were also in Austria at the beginning, the school was called the Austrian Economics. And today, it's still a very small school, small number of followers, and it's not taught in any universities, basically, maybe very few, but it's still a very small school, but it's gaining traction and more followers as people are asking questions about why things are the way they are. And today, you probably find the strongest proponents of Austrian economics at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in the U.S.
If we zoom over to Sweden a little bit and getting to that a little bit more in detail as a contrast, I mean, I want to hear a little bit more about your experiences being, on both sides of the Atlantic and, you know, this kind of, I guess, Keynesian economics that we have largely over in Europe and if there are any differences in America primarily. But if we stick to Sweden at first here, it has obviously changed very much in the last, 10, 20 years, something like that. And some have said for the worse, some have said for the better. It would, of course, depend on in what area you're talking about specifically. But we have, to a certain extent, moved away from, Per Albin Hansson's Folkhemmet, the people's home, this very centralized idea of governance and planned economy and everything else. But we also have kept many aspects. They're still there. And the Swedes, as you said before, has been steeped in this way of thinking and operating that has been difficult for a lot of people to, I think, both accept some of the changes that have been coming in and realize that it's not the same Sweden, that people might be accustomed to thinking about. Even I think internationally people have a different opinion of what it is. But how would you define the changes that has occurred in Sweden in the last 10, 20 years or so? Has we, in your opinion, moved anyway, in a better direction in terms of freedom and liberty, or are we still very much there, but the language has changed? How do you view this, Klaus?
It's a hard question to answer because there's so many, as you say, there's so many aspects to to it, and it's not easy to say whether something is good or bad when it has 1,000 different parameters. To describe the development of Sweden over the last few years, I would say it's become very materialistic. And that is not only on the individual level, but it's also on the government level. There are very little principles involved in governing Sweden. Almost all decisions are made. If something is good for the economy, I mean, that's the common, probably the most common reason for doing things. Well, this is good for the economy. This is good for the economy. We need to get mothers out to work. It's good for the economy. It's good for GDP. It's good for taxes. We need to take control over this sector of the economy. It's good for people. It's good for the economy. And to me, that is only a tool, because you can't say on a large scale, in a collectivistic fashion, what is good for people.
Yeah.
So in that way, and this reflects in many different levels of society, there's a very strong control over people. And so the desire to find collectivistic solutions, one size fits all,
yeah,
in many, many areas of Swedish society. And you see it in healthcare. There's one solution for everybody. You see it in the school system. There's one school plan for everybody. You see it in, there are many, many, many different areas. You see it in business. You see it in the media and so on. So it's a centralization of power. It's a centralization and a unification of thinking and ideas. It goes hand in hand with that. At the same time, Sweden has become very individualistic, very superficial and materialistic in many ways. And I think you especially see that in the bigger cities. There's a lack of depth. There's a lack of values, I would say.
Why is that? Where does that come from, do you think? Because, I mean, I agree with you. I see that as well. I wouldn't put it over to the side that it's maybe a lack of religion per se, but it's a lack of just a deeper realization of what they're part of. It seems like it's very, as you say, it's a very short-term thinking, and I think it is a product from both a more scientific view, of course, but at the same time, as you said, everything that has to do with planning everything, it's steeped in safety and security, and that's kind of the background. And as part of that, there arise very few challenges, I would say, that actually helps to deepen personalities and to, you know, difficulties that you can learn from. I mean, this might have been more true so in the 70s than it is now, but it's still there to a large extent. Would you agree with that?
I would. And people hardly know how to solve problems themselves anymore. It's kind of fun when you look at kids in school. I see sometimes the things my children brought home. They're trained to think, not solve problems themselves, but how can they use the government apparatus to solve problems. So there could be an exercise. Well, here's a social problem. Somebody's smoking at the bus stops. And some people are allergic to smoke. How would you solve it? Well, the right answer is to go to your lawmakers and propose a new law and vote on that and solve the problem. That is the correct answer. So people don't think so much anymore. How can I solve the problem? Could I perhaps talk to somebody who's smoking and blowing smoke in my face? Or maybe I can talk to the bus operator company, or I can, you know. But it's always the political solutions to things, always these central solutions, one solution for everybody. And getting back to the other question you had, why do we get this? Why do we have this superficial society? I actually think it has to do with the lack of religion, as you say, and also a lack of deep interest in deeper thinking. When you look, first of all, parents don't have so much time for their children in Sweden. So everybody's very busy working so they can pay for all the free stuff that we get. I mean, one of the major banks came up with a number about a year ago and said, well, in Sweden, if you add everything up, we pay about 70% tax.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a pretty high price for all the free stuff. So, of course, a lot of parents have to work very, very long hours to pay for all of this. That means you don't have so much contact between parents and children. And these values that are normally taught from the older generation to the younger, deeper discussions and sort of philosophical questions, religious questions, there's no time for that. And to a large extent, people expect schools to teach children values today. Now, how are you going to teach values to children that come from different parents and increasingly also from different countries?
Yeah.
How do you do that in a uniform way? Hmm. Well, you can. So you don't. Instead, schools focus on more tax-profiting activities, like teaching math, teaching science, teaching language, and so on. Instead of, I'm not proposing that schools should teach values at all. Absolutely not.
Right. Right.
But there's an expectation that they should.
Sure.
But they can't. So children don't get much training in values and philosophical thinking and religious thinking and spirituality. So eventually that brings up a generation that, you know, is not interested or not knowledgeable in these questions. I mean, I read something about a couple of weeks ago, about French businessmen. They hate talking to Swedes. Because all they talk about is business,
right,
and profits. And, there's no, you know, no room for any interesting discussions on a personal level. Because Swedes don't know anything. They haven't read any classical books.
Has this been, I mean, bred out of the people for purposes of control? How far back do you take this?
That's always my big question. Is it stupidity or is it evil?
Right.
I don't really know how to answer the question, but I think there are a few people who do understand things and do have an interest in society taking a certain direction. But I think most people are just useful idiots. They believe it because they have been taught it, so they propagate it, and because they don't have the knowledge themselves or the interest, how can they teach somebody else about it? So it's created a very, very shallow, very materialistic society, unfortunately. Well, when I talk about these things, people think I hate Sweden, which I don't.
Right.
I feel sorry for Sweden.
Me too. Yeah. I agree. That's how I feel too.
Yeah. I would really love for it to be brought back to its senses. But I just want to say that, so.
Right. I had that as a question for you as well, that this sounds very, very harsh. You know, are there any good things about Sweden? We'll get to that later, of course. But so let's see here. You know, there are a couple of different aspects to this then that we can talk more about. We hear often in the international media that the parenting politics, if you will, of Sweden is to be praised. Schools are great. I mean, we'll get to the happiness part of this later. But there's many aspects to this that are being promoted in the international media, I've noticed. The Nordic model, the gender politics, for example. At the same time, as you talk about the lack of depth, there also seems to be, this goes hand in hand kind of with a pride from the Swedish people that we are, you know, we're progressive, we're far ahead in many of these questions. We know better than everyone else do, correct?
Yeah. And what's interesting is you will find, when you talk to the average Swede, you will find that he will have the opinion that we are so far progressed and everybody is so far behind. But everybody who is behind, they are trying to be like us. And eventually they will succeed. It's just a matter of time before they have been able to transform themselves into what we are. There's very little understanding that some other people may have other views and other ways of managing their society. So it's quite conceited in that way, believing that we have the one solution that's going to work for everybody. I don't know why it's so praised. I believe it is praised because we have in Sweden been able to do what a lot of governments want to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
They want to centralize power. It's their job. More power to the government, more power to the, you know, politician. And Sweden is one of the most centralized countries in the world in that sense. And of course, that's something that all politicians want to do. Most of them, anyway. There are very few exceptions. So they will praise it. They will say, well, they have this and that. You know, they have free this and that. Wouldn't you like to have free healthcare? Of course I want free healthcare. They have free schools. Wouldn't you like that? Oh, yeah. So you sell it that way. And then they can, you know, expand their power. So it sounds like a conspiracy, but that's just how people work.
Well, but it is. That's what I found anyway, that this is an active tactics to subjugate people under their control. And I mean, as you say, this is not maybe for evil purposes. This is just the nature of government itself, that it seeks as much control as it can because it benefits the organization to the larger extent, you know?
Yeah.
So a lack of people also speaking up about these things also at the same time gives the appearance that people are they're content with the system, they're going ahead with it, it's everything is fine, we don't hear any voices of critique. There's, of course, numerous reasons for this, from the media being, you know, partly subsidized by the government. We have an aspect of control there. At the same time, when you have these international happiness index polls being run and everything else, you have I've noticed that some of the questions, Klaus, is more oriented towards, if you could rate level of corruption in your country from 1 to 10, you know, how corrupt is it kind of thing? And then the people answer that, and then the, you know, results are written, and then articles are written on those results. But all of this has an implication that people have to be aware of these social problems, and which goes back to the original point that you mentioned before, that if there is a lack of awareness, a lack of interest in these kinds of questions, people, first of all, won't be aware of them, so they can't answer correctly to them, and then the rest of the world will see these things as being, you know, that the people within the country is content, so therefore the system must be working, correct?
Yeah. There is a lack of awareness, definitely. And there is also a lot of propaganda. It's impossible to put one country next to the other and compare and put a number on the level of corruption. It's meaningless. But that's one important factor in these happiness investigations that, you know, people and companies do sometimes. But you can just take, there's so many examples. On the lower level, like, for townships, you can see many examples of local politicians giving contracts to, you know, cousins, relatives, friends for building the next arena or the next big mall or something like that. That goes on all the time.
Yeah.
And of course, on the higher level, on the national level, you have the same lobby organizations in Sweden as you have everywhere else. That's not usually called corruption. It's called advice or something like that. But it's the same thing. They buy laws, they buy contracts, same thing goes on. But it's impossible to put a number on it. But I would say it's a fairly corrupt country in that sense.
Very much so, I think. It's, again, I go back to the conspiratorial view here, but I think for the reasons that so many things have been managed to be kept hidden, people have willingly given up their power of decision making, freedom, individuality, everything else to the government, to authority, this is a very much a favorable way of running things in other countries around the world as well. Do you think that that's primarily what's behind the promotion of it? I mean, if we look at it from the Nordic model of economics, for example, specifically, how do you see that this is being promoted around the world, and what would be your level of critique against this? I mean, I've read studies from Duke University to Harvard, from people who are talking very fondly about Sweden and their way of running things, and even that they've even tried to argue that this is actually the system that Americans prefer it, they just don't know it yet.
Yeah, do you mean how it's been marketed? Or?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you see a lot of these, a lot is done by universities in the U.S. Harvard is of course, a good one. And most universities are leftist today, in one degree or another. They have been, I mean, if you want to destroy something and corrupt it, then you should get the government involved in it, and you should get government funding. And it's a very simple process. I mean, if you are a government and you want to corrupt something and take it over, give them money. First they will use the money as a sort of an extra, but pretty soon it will be incorporated in the regular budget, and they can't do without it. And to keep the money coming, you have to promote the message. And through this process, a lot of universities, I mean, in Sweden, most all universities are government-run, but in the U.S., there are still private universities, but they are all, to one degree or another, dependent on government funding as well. And, of course, then you have all these policy departments, political science, and so on, and they will be, a lot of leftist people will come there.
Right.
And they will, of course, look at Sweden as a perfect example of how to run a society. Again, you don't need a conspiracy. It's just the nature of government.
Yeah.
A lot of it comes from academia.
Yeah, it does. Exactly. And this seems to be, the nature of how you coerce and take over a population because of the nature of, education and that system. That's just how you do it. And since that's, a lot of this comes from government funding, as you say, it's very important to kind of spread that message. But a lot of things during the last few years then have been, a lot have been privatized in Sweden. It's gone through a lot of these different changes. At the same time, we have very much the same core system of this idea of folkhemmet, the people's home, kind of at the center of everything. But due to the privatization, a lot of people have said that this is the evidence that we've completely moved away from that model of what Palmen, the social democrats, were basically running for a very, very long time. I think record time in any country in the world for the amounts of years that they actually managed to hold political control over a country. But how much would you say is still there from that period? Is this a period that we're still kind of reeling from and trying to get, back up on our feet on? I mean, there's, of course, a lot of different opinions on this, but what's your view on that?
Well, this whole business about privatization, it's something that requires its own show.
Yeah.
In any way.
Yeah.
Because most of it's fake. I mean, I kind of see a process goes like this, works in several steps. First, you get the desire to centralize something. Say, just as an example, there's a child on the news, can't afford shoes, right? So somebody grabs the opportunity. We need to guarantee shoes for everyone. And somebody makes a career out of that. Let's centralize shoe distribution, or let's make sure every child has a pair of shoes. So you build up an authority to take care of this, and pretty soon you're going to destroy the private or the market for shoes. So to make this work, you have to set up a bureaucracy. You have to have criteria for who gets shoes. You have to sort of tender shoe makers who will provide the shoes. When you make it a bureaucracy, you have to make it uniform. It has to be one or maybe two types of shoes. and you totally destroy the shoe market, and everything becomes very rigid, inflexible, quality goes down, costs go up, and eventually the socialist idea crumbles, because people, you know, they're feet hurt because of all the bad shoes. at which point you say, well, we should privatize this. It's really too much to manage. So then what you do is you hand it over to the so-called free market. Okay, you can now produce the shoes. You can distribute the shoes. We will only regulate it.
Right.
And this is the catch.
Yeah.
You say you privatize, but you continue to regulate. And this, of course, builds up total corruption, because shoe companies will then buy the regulators. They will buy the contracts. There will be bribes. There will be, well, all this corruption that we talked about. And you will have maybe one or two or three big shoe companies winning all the contracts, making higher margins, producing worse and worse shoes, but still winning the contracts because they write the criteria and the regulations. And this is what's happening with almost all of these so-called privatizations. You see it in healthcare. You see a few big companies running a lot of so-called private hospitals. And then they move the profits out of the country, which makes people angry because they're taking tax money, moving it abroad, not paying taxes for it, making huge profits, while at the same time, there are long, long waiting times at the hospitals.
Yeah.
So then, and you see it in so many other examples. You see it in the banking system. You see it in drugstores in Sweden, which used to be government-run, but it's been so-called privatized, but it's regulated. You see it in so many places. And then what people do is they blame the free market or capitalism, because
right,
they believe this
right.
is capitalism.
Yeah.
But to be a true free market, you need to remove all the regulation, as it was in the shoe business before government got the great idea of providing shoes for everyone. Unless you remove all the regulation, it's not a free market, and it will be corrupted. So this is the process as I see it. And then, when people hate capitalism, you're ready for another takeover of the industry by politicians. So that's the process as I see it, anyway.
So it's like we've gotten the worst of two different systems, really.
Yeah, it's probably this kind of privatization is probably worse than a state-run system.
Well, that's what it's about.
Then at least you know who to blame.
Well, exactly. That's right. And there's a number of examples of this that we've seen. You know, the railways, the phone industry. There's a number of areas where you've had a number of companies coming on to the market to take over after the government was running some of these things, and then, but you say that there's still, it's almost like a cartel behind that, because it's still very much regulated by the one industry. Like, take the phone industry, for example. You have a government-run company that operates the actual physical lines, Scanova in the case of the phone lines and everything else. So there's just so much that can be done when it comes to, you know, pushing down prices and everything else. It becomes the illusion of option, and nothing really happens. And what has happened in that case is that the prices have actually gone up as opposed to gone down, you know?
Yeah. And then people say, oh, this doesn't work, this free market business. It's a myth. And you see it also, as you said, phone lines, you see it in the electric grid, you see it in the rail network, and so on. You see it in so many areas, and it fails everywhere.
Yeah.
It's sad in that way, because people get the wrong idea. And as you say, it's totally correct. Regulation of an industry is cartelization.
Yeah.
The best way of reaping huge profits in an industry is to make sure it's regulated. Because running a cartel is a hard thing. There's always the temptation for one of the cartel members to cheat the cartel, to lower prices, to add features, to improve the product, and they will gain at the expense of the others in the cartel. It's very, very hard to keep a cartel together. So what you need to do is you need to get a third party involved that forces everybody to stay in line. And that is what regulation is. That is why you regulate the financial markets. That's why you regulate the banks. That's why you regulate the healthcare. That's why you regulate railroads or phones or drugstores or whatever. It is to make sure that the cartel keeps together.
What is the, and I mean, we have so much more to discuss, Klaus, and we will continue in, you know, a little bit here in the second hour and talk more about this and the bigger, you know, picture, both, you know, your perspective. You've been over in America a little bit, and, you know, I want to ask you about how you see things changing there right now as well. But do you think that the root of this ultimately is people's, I go back to fear, actually, because a lot of this has to do with safety and security. It's we've been promised certain guarantees throughout, you know, Swedish history. A lot of the social democratic and even the so-called conservatives over in Sweden for a long time, you know, they were running on these kinds of premises that it's safe and we need to, it's going to be safe, protected, everything else. And at the same time, none of that turned out to actually work because, you know, the crash eventually came. Everything has been, as I see it, you know, run into the ground practically after that stage. So none of this has worked, but yet people bought the lie, if you will, of appeal to safety. What would you say to that?
I would absolutely agree. Government cannot guarantee any kind of safety. It's impossible. And there are so many examples of it. Just take labor market, for example. So in the 50s, you could go down to the local port and you could get a job for the day, loading cargo or something, and you could get paid at the end of the day. There was always work to do. Always. Now, after government started guaranteeing jobs by introducing legislation for labor protection and employment protection and so on, it's become very hard to find a job. It's definitely not a one-day gig. We can find a job the same day and quit the same day. To me, that is true security. Being able to find employment and income in one day. It's not true security to be guaranteed a job for life and then, in the end, not being able to find work because people don't want to employ.
Yeah. There's just an endless slew of problems here. I mean, and the situation now is that you can hardly hire people and you can hardly fire people. You know, that's the situation like in Sweden. And again, all majority of this comes around from the security thing again, that as you say, you have to be guaranteed certain things. And this, I mean, do you think Sweden ever will wake up to any of this, or will the virus, as I say at this point, just spread to other countries as I fear?
Well, at Mises.se, where I'm active, Swedish Mises site, and we've talked about these things for a long time. Why do we do what we do? Why do we write? Why do we promote these ideas? It's all useless anyway. I mean, it's not going to change anything. But the reason what keeps us up is, first of all, we enjoy it. It's a fun thing to poke your finger in the eye of stupidity. But also, we, and people call us utopian. You know, your type of society, free society, can never work. It's never worked. Look what we have today. You had your chance. You know, we were free, and look what we have. This is what people have voted for, and so on. But we look further ahead. We understand. We know by studying history and understanding how these things work that even though many people believe that we've reached the end of history, this is the sort of the pinnacle of civilization, and it will always be like this. We know it's not true. This is going away. If by no other means, it will go bankrupt. I don't think, we definitely have no influence over, we can write all day long, but we have no influence over what's going on. But we can make a few people aware, and we believe that once this goes away, to one degree or another, things have to be rebuilt. We want to, just want to make sure that enough people understand how things work for real and how they could be.
Mm.
So that when that time comes, we can seize the opportunity and build something better.
Well, very good. We'll round things off with the first segment on that note, Klaus. And why don't you give out some of your websites, if there's any, Facebook pages, or if there's any other, you know, ongoing events that you have that you'd like to promote and give out there, both for people in the in Sweden, I guess, but also in the U.S.
I actively write on Mises.se, which is a sort of Swedish version of Mises.org. Mises, the Ludwig Mises Institute in the U.S., they promote Austrian economics and liberty. I read quite a bit on LouRockwell.com as well. And sometimes on Tom Woods, who's a Mises guy. Yeah, has a radio show. And those are probably the main sites I look at. And then, as you know, with the internet, you start in one place and you branch out somewhere else. But these are my starting points.
All right, very good. Well, we're going to have these links up there. Mises.se.org and then LouRockwell.com as well. We're going to proceed and talk more with Klaus here in the second segment. So stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back with more. In the second hour, we get more into some history, including some of Olof Palme's disastrous decisions. We discuss service economy, education, and schooling. Later, we get more into many of the myths surrounding the Swedish healthcare system, and they are many indeed. All you fans of Obamacare, listen up as we proceed in the second hour to give you an idea of where it might be heading. To proceed to listen to the second hour, you can sign up for a membership at redicemembers.com. Enjoy our archives. We have tons of material for you to explore. But before we proceed, I just want to let you know about some of our upcoming guests on Red Ice Radio. Ingrid Carlqvist from Dispatch International. We have James Swagger, Steve Gorham, and then later Jason Erb. Next, however, is Radio 314. We have a program with Pete Henriksson coming up on cracking the IRS code. Very interesting. Don't miss that one. All right, folks, thank you for staying with us for this first hour. We'll continue to educate and outline what we hope is not to come. Second hour now with Klaus Bandpaintner just around the corner.